quality or service. As a result, Visa's unlawful conduct affects not just the price of one thing, but the price of nearly everything. Close quote. For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin.
Welcome to Africa Now. Today's show features Somalia, impacts of external dynamics, climate change, and more. Africa Now is next. Welcome to Shaw Mwiza Muntali. Your music in the background is Sojourn by Patrice Rushen, commemorating a birthday which is September 30. For many years, Somalia has been afflicted by attacks by Al-Shabaab and clan-based conflicts. Countries within the region and beyond have in many instances exacerbated the conflicts and political crisis in Somalia. The show contextualizes Somalia's relationships with countries such as Egypt, Ethiopia, Kenya, the U.S., the U.K., and UAE. Dr. Sadia Adin joins the show to unpack the impacts of external dynamics, climate change, and more on the long-standing conflicts and political crisis in Somalia. Dr. Sadia Adin is a humanitarian activist and freelance writer. Here is the conversation. Sadia Adin, welcome to the show. Oh, I should say welcome back to the show. It's been a while.
Thank you.
First of all, I wanted to talk to you about, in Somalia, the effects of climate change on the country, especially the agriculture sector, farming sector, and if you could just touch on, if you can start there, so to give people context of what's happening in Somalia today.
Well, thank you so much for having me. And you're right, I'm glad to be back. The climate change, of course, it has impact on, I guess, around the world. But for Somalia, it has intensified and it has increased the already existing vulnerabilities of the Somali society because it has created or it continues to create various or vicious, I should say, cycle of drought, food insecurity, displacement, floods and conflict. So the unpredictable weather pattern, longer droughts and more intense floods have severely undermined livestock, with millions of people facing a chronic humanitarian crisis. Even though right now things are a bit better, this climate change in fact has a serious impact on Somalia. The lack of strong government also, institutions and infrastructures make it harder for Somalia to build resilience against the future climate shocks. As for the agricultural, that will come to the under the, I guess, food insecurity. There's reduced agricultural yields because of the unpredictable weather that have been disrupting planting seasons, which has led and continues to lead to poor harvest. In some areas, droughts lead to crop failures, while the others, floods wipe out entire fields. Also, the livestock, there is a lot of death on the livestock side. Communities suffer significantly when their livestock loses during the drought, with some of the animals dying from lack of water and grazing land. Primarily source of income and food for some majority of Somalis is livestock, and majority of Somalis' economy depends on that. So there's always the famine risk, which brings the prolonged droughts and compounded with the conflict. and the political instability, which continues again, goes back to the same problem. So it's more like a cycle. It's a continuous cycle. And there is a water shortage, diminishing water resources. There are two rivers in Somalia, Juba, which is and Shabelle, and both come through or originate from Ethiopia or come through the mountains of Ethiopia. And that, I guess, will come back to the issues that we have discussed earlier. I guess one of the other discussions on the Ethiopia and the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, which not only impacts Somalia, but also impacts neighboring countries like Egypt and Sudan.
Yeah, and also, as you mentioned, the impact of people's livelihood and agriculture. Before we go to the other sectors, I wanted to find out how this is also affecting the unpredictability of the weather and the crops yield and people's farming. It's also affecting youth employment, right? Because a lot of people were employed in this sector as well in the past.
Well, yes, Somalia, as many other African countries, a majority of Somali society is youth under the age of 75% of Somali public or society is under the age of 30. And already there has been a very serious unemployment crisis in Somalia. And when these sort of problems take place, such as the droughts and the floods, the impact of climate also impacts on the agricultural sector, and also impacting on the nomads that all depend mainly on livestock. And that not only creates more problems, the youth that are part of this sector, but also adds to the crisis already that exists, those in the urban areas, youth. And youth continue to struggle in Somalia, whether they are in the urban area or in the rural area. And that problem has sometimes resulted, unfortunately, for youth taking that dangerous journey of migrating to other countries, crossing not only borders, but also taking that risk migration across the ocean. And of course, many have died and continue to die, even though the numbers have decreased. Still, they have found other areas to travel through. Some now go through different countries and come through, surprisingly, through the Mexican-American border, instead of taking the journey that takes them through the seas toward the Mediterranean. So yeah, the youth have a very have taken the brunt of the pain on what's happening in Somalia.
And of course, the some other youth stay and some also get involved with some of the armed groups as well, right?
Yep.
Because of the lack of.
Of course, there's a clan-based conflict. There's also the insurgent groups like Al-Shabaab. And the majority of these are young people. If you remember, just to give it a context, Al-Shabaab, when most people are talking about, it sounds as though Al-Shabaab just came about. But if you remember, back in December 2006, when Ethiopia invaded Somalia, the Union of Islamic Courts, they were individual clan-based courts, some say religious, but they were really clan-based. They have united to fight off some of the warlords that have been attacking and capturing religious and traditional leaders and exchanging them for payment with the Western countries, especially with the United States. And because of the suffering of the Somali society, particularly the traditional elders and the religious leaders. There was an uprising within the Somali society, and that has led to the Union of Islamic Courts and had a military wing, which was mainly the young, now Al-Shabaab. And after Ethiopia was almost defeated, if you remember, there was that reconciliation process that took place in Djibouti, and that has resulted for 2009, Somalia and Ethiopia to reach agreement to end the hostilities and Ethiopia to withdraw. Unfortunately, what happened was Ethiopia has never really fully withdrawn from Somalia, and the reconciliation process that took place that time did not include Al-Shabaab, the military wing of the Union of Islamic Courts, that were on the ground fighting the Ethiopian forces, and the rest is history. They have never, of course, given up fighting, and they have morphed into a more dangerous entity, where now they're not just what we knew as a military wing of Union of Islamic Courts, but they are entities that include all kind of groups from neighboring countries and from other, other nationalities. Before it started as an organic movement, or I shouldn't say really movement, but as organic, meaning people from within Somalia, the young military wing of Union of Islamic Courts and those that they have recruited, because when Ethiopia invaded, the numbers have increased. And of course, they continue to increase. And then, of course, when the reconciliation took place and they felt that they were not part of that process, they were now brought into the fold. And unfortunately, the crisis only have worsened. And this continues to devastate Somalia until today, where the attacks, terror attacks, whether it's bombing, suicide bombing, or other bombing takes place in Somalia. And they attack government institutions, civilian institutions. Now, there are a lot of questions that are being raised, which is the Union of Islamic Courts and this military wing, Al-Shabaab, were against Ethiopia. But now, all of a sudden, with Ethiopia being occupied many parts of Somalia, Al-Shabaab don't go after Ethiopian forces. They continue to go after other Amisan, now ADMIS forces, as well as the Somali central government and sometimes regional areas and being innocent civilians. So it just makes you wonder what was the goal of the group when they have decided to divert their attention from Ethiopia and within to the Somali people.
Again, that's Dr. Sadia Aden. She is a humanitarian activist and a freelance writer. And we're looking at the situation in Somalia. And I interjected when you were about to say something in terms of the, you're expanding on the situation about the questions about Ethiopia and the Al-Shabaab connection. If you can continue what you're about to say.
Yeah. I was just saying that, those questions are being raised and many experts have been asking, why is it all of the sudden Al-Shabaab, which was against Ethiopia and the Ethiopian invasion, and rightfully so, when they were part of the Union of Islamic Courts, now are not interested in fighting the Ethiopian forces in Somalia, not those that are under the Amisan umbrella or ADMIS, but those that have been freelancing in Somalia, especially Jubaland area, where it's not all of Jubaland, but in the Gedda regions and the southwest regions. that really raises questions on what have happened and how did they changed from people who were fighting invasion to people who are indifferent to the continued Ethiopian occupation in Somalia. And then, of course, you have the government and security forces, weak central authority. Not only this government, but every other federal government that came since the reconciliation have been weak. And then there is also, where they have, despite efforts to establish functioning government, Somali central authority remains fragile. The government gets a lot of support from international partners. They continue to fight al-Shabaab, but the efforts are not all holy because you have a government that's arming civilians to fight al-Shabaab. And when those civilians feel that they have defeated al-Shabaab, they use those guns toward their own people, and that contributes also to the clan conflict, because when you arm clans are unpredictable and they are all protecting their own territorial, what they call our territory, which is clan fiefdoms or clan areas. So that's some of the mistakes the government has made and they continue to make, especially since the arms embargo was lifted on December of last year. Weapons have been flooding into Somalia, and not only from neighboring countries, and not only what federal government is bringing in, but also independent contractors and regional states have been also importing weapons. So importation has increased since the arms embargo was lifted. And that really creates a more concern, because there's no regulations coming from the government, because government doesn't have the capacity to regulate what is coming in and out of Somalia, because government is not really in charge of the borders of Somalia, whether it's the land or the sea. There's a bit control on the space where they're able to return some of the flights coming from Ethiopia here and there. But in the long run, I mean, in the overall, Somalia's government really doesn't have that much of a capacity. And the Somali National Army, even though they're gradually improving, they still remain under-equipped and they're reliant on international support, particularly from ATMIS, Transition Mission in Somalia, that transformed from African, from Amazon, which has been instrumental in helping Somalia in different ways, but has not been successful in really bringing about the stability Somalia needed. And then there are the regional militias, various clan-based militias and regional forces complicate the issue, the security landscape. And I say this because Somalia is a federal state, or Somalia has decided to, Somalia did not really decide to accept the federal system. But the Somali politicians who were able to meet in these different areas in Ethiopia, in Kenya, and before that 2000 in Djibouti, have decided to develop a system, a federal-based system, which was never really voted on by the Somali society, which have not been decided by the Somali society, which have not been endorsed by any sector of the Somali society. And when I say any sector, is referendum has not been taken where people have decided whether Somalia should have a federal system, or they have should have a central system, or they should have a you know, central governing system or something in between. That is, the jury is still out on that, but Somalis who are in authority positions always claim Somali is a federal system and Somali has accepted the federal system. But it's not really what Somalia as a nation has accepted or has voted for, or this people, Somalis, society or civilians have voted for. It's something that has been imposed on people. But the Somali community or Somali society or Somali public don't seem to have any authority to challenge that. Right now, they're struggling to survive, whether it's from the droughts or from the floods or from the insecurity. And when Somali is secure and able to function as a normal a sovereign state that is able to control its borders, whether it's, you know, land, sea, or you know, skies, and every Somali is able to walk on the streets peacefully without worrying about being blown up by Al-Shabaab or any other entity in Somalia, there will not be a way to express the will of the people. And to do that, those things that I've just described have to happen. I hope that makes sense.
Oh, yeah, no, it does. And it kind of clarifies also. I wanted to also get back to, I think, to unpack what you've said so that those of us who don't follow it as closely as we'd like to, and of course, it doesn't get into the media as much, particularly when you mentioned the African Union troops. Right now, it's the current name of the African Union troops is the African Union Transition Mission, right? That's
Yeah, Transition Mission in Somalia, ATMIS, yes.
In Somalia. And then, and then at the end of the year, it's going to become the African Union Support and Stabilization Mission. And that's AUSOM. And
yeah,
all these acronyms and
all these acronyms, don't really help
I wanted to find out that before we go, first I wanted to unpack the AU's role. Maybe you can expand on what you just said. How has it been seen on the ground, and how effective has it been for the people?
Well, the African Union, or now ATMIS, there is a mixed feelings about the African Union troops. African Union troops originally supposed to be, when the whole discussion started, it was to have African forces in Somalia, but to make sure that the frontline states were not included or were not part of that process. But of course, that has not been honored or have not been, no one has actually obeyed the rules that have been set in place.
Yeah, so, because to interject, even a country like Egypt right now is going to be sending troops, right?
Before Egypt, Somalia, the troops were Uganda and Burundi. And Sierra Leone, and then Kenya came in without being part of the Amazon umbrella. They just came in and invaded Somalia, crossed the border back in 2011, saying that they were pursuing Al-Shabaab. That's actually how Kenyan troops have ended up in Somalia. And all of a sudden, by default, they became part and parcel of the Amazon troops. And then you had Ethiopia, which has also joined under the first term of President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud, where they joined came under the umbrella of Amazon. But the problem with Ethiopia is, even though they supposed to be under that umbrella, of course, without the desire of the Somali people, they have also had these troops that have not been part of Amazon or have not been blessed by the Somali government or by Amazon that have just crossed the border. And they have occupied areas in the Gedda region, which is part of the Jubaland regional state. And they have also occupied areas in Bay and Bakool area, which is the southwest region of Somalia. And they continue to stay there for the last almost 10, 15 years. And no one is able to challenge them. No one is able to evict them. They have a full authority to do whatever that they want in these regions. And those that are part of Amazon or after that now transitioned into ADMIS, they're supposed to be leaving, but the way it seems, that's not going to be happening. And now in the mix, what's even worse is Egypt seems to be joining the new forces that are in play for the coming year to be part of this for African forces. And the reason is not because Egypt really has so much love and desire to fight for Somalia, but because there are so many things that are happening at the same time. Ethiopia have signed a memorandum of understanding with one of the regions of Somalia called Somaliland. Back in January of this year. And when they signed that, there was a tension that has started between Somalia and Ethiopia. And of course, the tensions have increased between the regional state of Somaliland and the nearby areas like the outer region, which is on the border with Ethiopia. Ethiopia also continues to interfere with Somalia. Not only do they have troops, but they have they had a consulate in Hargeisa, which they have now upgraded as an ambassador. And so here you're talking about a regional state, even though they're claiming the political.
Sorry to interject. Hargeisa is in Somaliland. For those who don't know where it is,
it's Hargeisa was the second capital city of Somalia before the civil war started. And then remember when the militias came, each militia decided to take sections of Somalia, and SNM, Somali National Movement, was mainly from that area. And they have decided to say, not only do we want to control this area, but now we're going to secede, which was not the original plan, by the way, of the militia. So that region has been getting a lot of support from the international community, especially from UK, even United States, when it comes to humanitarian support, development support.
But and you're talking about the region of Somaliland, right?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. But there was this region called Somaliland was actually is home to many different clans that don't agree on the idea of secession. Even within the same clan that everyone accuses to be the secessionist clan, within them, they don't even really agree on the secession. Some are unionist, pro-unionist, some are neutral, and some are, of course, with the secessionist group. Now, within that area, there was an area that used to be called disputed area, which was Sol, Senak, and Ain, SSC. And if you remember last year, there was a serious conflict within that Somali, so-called Somaliland, where the people against the secession and those that were for the secession started, of course, firing. The reason was because people of Sol, Senak, and Ain, especially Sol, had their people being killed, especially some of the youth, businessmen, elders, traditional elders. And finally, there was an uprising within that community, and they fought against the regional authority based in Hargeisa. And it was a horrible conflict. Many, many people, hundreds, if not thousands of people have died on both areas, on both sides. But at the end, people of SCC have succeeded not only pushing back the authority in Hargeisa, but also capturing many of hundreds of their soldiers and in detaining them in the Las Anod area, which is the capital city of Seoul. So now Somaliland, which has been claiming to be independent and has been saying we succeeded, all of a sudden now has fractured. And what surprised everyone was how divided the area was, because within the clans that everyone thought was supporting the secession have started among themselves fighting. There was a conflict within the Bur'a area, which is outside another city further out from Hargeisa. So that continues, and Ethiopia continues to mingle, you know, meddle with the affairs of the of Somalia, where they still support this movement of the secession movement. And that MOU also created a very serious, not only tension within that area, but also between Somalia and Ethiopia, because that included Ethiopia taking partial or part of the Somali Sea in that area and using it for there as a military base.
You're listening to a portion of a conversation with Dr. Sadia Aden, who unpacks the impacts of external dynamics, climate change, and more on the longstanding conflicts and political crisis in Somalia. Dr. Sadia Aden is a humanitarian activist and freelance writer. The music in the background is musical Oud by Hadith Bani Adam. You're listening to Africa Now on WPFW 89.3 FM in Washington, D.C., your jazz and justice station. Now back to the conversation.
They're supposed to, sorry to interject, one of the, you're talking about the agreement, one of the parts of the agreement is that they would have access to the sea.
The sea,
yeah.
It's not only access, but they want to establish actually a
Navy base.
Because they have been training. Ethiopia has bought, I remember a few years ago we've been talking about this, about 5 ships, and they have been training people. I mean, they have been training, sailors to basically take over this area and to control the area and to manage not only as a place where they can have access to the sea so they can use for importing and exporting, but also to have that military base. And the rumor has it, because of the conflict in Gaza and what's happening with Yemen, with the Houthis, the Western countries are also pushing Ethiopia to be part and parcel of this process, where they need to be in this area to help with controlling the Houthis. But that's, of course, a far-fetched, some people say. Others say maybe there is something to it. But Ethiopia, nevertheless, is very involved, deeply involved in the Somali affairs and has been pushing for this access to the sea and establishing the military base. But also, if you remember, Ethiopia had already many conflicts within itself, where the Tigrayan people were against the government, and the government, of course, pushed back in a harsh way, killing thousands and thousands of innocent Tigrayan civilians, and also not only defeating them militarily, but also starving people. So there was a very serious humanitarian crisis in Ethiopia. And now there's the Amhara also fighting against the government. And, the crisis in Ethiopia is continuing, but they still pushing for the idea of establishing military base in Somalia.
And also recently we just saw reports of Somalia saying that Ethiopia has been shipping weapons to Puntland, which is right next to Somaliland.
Yeah.
What is the information on the ground about that as well?
In the Somali sense, Somaliland is called northwest of Somalia, and Puntland is northeast of Somalia. Ethiopia has been funneling weapons not only in one section of Somalia, but throughout Somalia. They have been arming individuals and groups and clan militias in different regions in Somalia. And the idea was not to fight Shabaab, but actually to make sure that they had full control on the areas that they wanted to have their troops in. So in the event where there is a conflict, because of now Egypt being in the mix, because of the Ethiopian Renaissance or the dam or the GERD, which has a very serious impact on the Blue Nile River near the border with Sudan. Once that was completed, it became a very success story for the Ethiopians, and they supported it, and everyone expected for it to provide electricity for 2 million of Ethiopians and neighboring countries. But it also impacted on the livelihood of the Egyptian people. Nile River, for example, over 90% of it is freshwater needs for Egypt are being impacted because of what Ethiopia is doing. The Blue Nile originates from Ethiopia, you know that. And it contributes 85% Nile's total flow of water downstream. So Ethiopia could not Egypt could not convince Ethiopia to either halt building the dam or managing it in a way that was conducive for a peaceful regional collaboration. So now, since Egypt has failed to do that, what Egypt is trying to do is to use Somalia and have a proxy war, so they will be able to sort of have an impact on Ethiopia and affect Ethiopia's insecurity even further. So they will be able to have in a position where they can negotiate with Ethiopia to establish some sort of understanding where it will be win-win for the two countries. But Egypt is actually trying to use Somalia to achieve the success that it wants with Ethiopia. And that's really a crisis that Somalia and the region are not ready for.
Yeah, and as you said, Egypt is using Somalia. And of course, Egypt gets a lot of military aid from the United States. And for a long time, especially the use of the Nile, Egypt was given like control basically under colonial rule. You know, they had, which the other countries have always been upset about, mm-hmm. because there are many countries on the Nile Basin, and they've always been upset about Egypt having total control of the use of the Nile. For Somalia, how do they see this imposition of Egypt? Now, Egypt coming in and saying that they're going to come in and support the government. How do ordinary people see Egypt's role, particularly when Egypt has this very interesting relationship with the United States, this one of the biggest military Egypt gets some of the biggest military support from the United States, and is really seen as the agent right there for the United States.
Absolutely, absolutely. You're right. United States, the funding from United States to Egypt is huge. And, one thing that everyone knows who have been following this is with this agreement where the Somali government have signed with Egypt, the military or security sector support with Egypt, it's not something right really that just came out of the, you know, thin air. It's something obviously United States government supports, otherwise the deal would not have continued or would not have finalized. So one thing that we know is United States is not very happy with what's going on in Ethiopia. Ahmed Abiy, the prime minister of Ethiopia, who was the darling of the West when he first came, because they thought he was going to deliver everything that, of course, West expected from Ethiopia and other states in the region, did not really turn out to be what they thought he was going to be. He was even given, if you remember, the Nobel Peace Prize for establishing peace with Eritrea, giving Eritrea the disputed area. But after that, everything just fell apart. And not only that, he just went after one ethnic group, and if not this one, it went after the other. For example, after Tigrayan people, and then it went after the Amharas, and it continues to do that. And even Somalis have not been spared, even though, of course, Somalis have not suffered close to what the Tigrayan people and the Amharas have gone through. But nevertheless, the government has given the Oromos a free hand to attack Somali regions in Ethiopia, basically land grabbing and doing a lot of other things in the Somali region within Ethiopia. So United States is able to do a lot of things, but because of the election, the uncertainty of the elections, what's going on in the Middle East, especially in Gaza, you know, Palestine and Israel, and of course, what's happening with the Houthis, there are so many complexities and so many complications no one has anticipated that are taking place. Therefore, United States will give the go-ahead to one country like Egypt, and of course also Turkey also signed agreement with Somalia. And before that, a few years ago, United States and the Western countries could not even hear or accept the idea of Turkey having base in Somalia or having security agreement with Somalia. Now, all of a sudden, everyone is quiet about it. And that itself raises some eyebrows and, you know, raises the question, what's happening? Why is that not being challenged? And it could be, again, to keep Turkey busy here so they don't continue to talk about the crisis in Gaza and what's happening in Palestine. So there are so many things that are happening, very complicated issues, as there are so many countries that are involved in Somalia's internal affairs. It's not only Ethiopia, it's not only Kenya, it's United Arab Emirates, it's Qatar, and then you have these freelance private security forces that are everywhere in Somalia right now. And then you have within Somalia, the capital city of Somalia, there is this place called Halane. It's one of the biggest camp that some of the previous, before 1990, Somali government used to use to train the Somali forces and also civilians who are being taught on how to, you know, train on some activities on the first year. They used to call the national, what did they call? They called national service. I think that's what it was. That place right now, majority of the embassies are in that area. It's like a green zone. Basically, the Halane close to the airport is one side and the rest of Mogadishu is on the other side. And you have all these embassies, international embassies, housed in this area. Amazon, majority of it's housed in there. These private militias are there. Remember Prince, who had the Blackwater, if you remember, the Iraq War.
The Iraq War, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Now he sort of, changed colors and he's involved with the United Arab Emirates, where he trains these private forces or private militia, or I don't know what else. But basically, they can go anywhere and be part of any conflict. They are based in Helena. There are so many of them that are in the mix. They are in Puntland. They are in Jubaland. They are also outside Mogadishu, where the Beledweyne, where the U.S. government has forces. So things are really bad in Somalia. And until all these forces leave Somalia and Somalia is able to have its own military or arm to secure the borders and provide security and genuine reconciliation takes place, Somalia is not able to handle a lot of the things that we see right now, a lot of the complexities that involve with all these countries.
And as you mentioned, the United Arab Emirates, UAE, that's what you said. You said Prince is there, right? And
he's in Emirates.
And then so that's also, that country is also implicated in the situation in Sudan as well.
Yes.
So with the arms and at the end of the day, also you have lurking in the background the United States, who are close to the UAE. And other countries. So you always wonder what the U.S. policy. But I wanted to expand. One always sees the hidden role of the U.S. policy in some, especially Somalia-Ethiopia relationship for so many years. Throughout the years,
yeah.
A lot of the arms have come from the United States in that struggles. I wanted to also expand a bit more on Turkey, because Turkey is playing a mediation role, trying to mediate between Ethiopia and Somalia. And there was a scheduled to have meetings on the 17th, but it's been postponed. Do you think this mediation effort that Turkey is doing will come to any positive results? Considering that Turkey has close ties with Somalia, they've built schools, hospitals, and other infrastructure. Do you think they'll be successful in mediating peace? At least now there's a diplomatic tension between the two countries. The ambassador to Ethiopia was sent back to his country. Do you think Turkey will be successful, considering that they have close ties with Somalia?
Well, Turkey, first of all, you're right. Turkey was very successful in establishing soft power in Somalia, establishing schools, helping rebuild the schools, provide trainings to Somali military, thousands and thousands, providing supporting hospitals, training healthcare workers. So Turkey was very successful and have done something that the rest of the world has not done in Somalia since the Somali collapse in 1991. If you remember, during 2011, Somalia was no-go zone. Every country said Somalia was not safe. It was a failed state, and no one could go there. And all of a sudden, the current president of Turkey, then prime minister, with his whole cabinet or majority of them and his family have landed in Mogadishu with a Turkish airline. And not only that, but he was able to provide that to sort of eliminate that a perception of saying Somali is no-go zone. It's a failed state. But his government, Turkey, was able to say, it's okay to come to Somalia. You're able to come to Somalia. If you want to really help Somalia, you're able to come. People are not going to eat you. They're human beings who are in need, who need support, who need a helping hand, who need humanitarian support, who need security, who need everything under the earth that anyone needs to survive. So many countries, even organizations, non-profit organizations that avoided Somalia and who were operating from Kenya and Ethiopia and Djibouti, all of a sudden started slowly coming to Somalia and working, not only in the smaller sector that they were in, but now be expanding and reaching out more area to more areas and to more people and being part of the rebuilding process. When I say rebuilding, is the morale of the society, providing some sort of a semblance of security, semblance of hope. So Turkey really has succeeded way before these countries even decided to come to Somalia by just simply using the soft power. Now all of a sudden, all the countries started to pour into Somalia. But instead of doing what Turkey was doing, where they built the biggest embassy in all of Africa in Somalia, Mogadishu, outside the green, outside the Halane, where all the others are, majority of them housed in the Halane. So no matter what happens, Turkey is always seen as a favorable country, a nation, because they're showing that they want to be closer to people and stay connected with the people, so they will be able be more supportive to the Somali society. The only thing now that's changing with Turkey is that they're sort of modifying their original tactic, which was using soft power. Now being part of the struggle to win sectors of Somalia's security.
You just been listening to a portion of a conversation with Dr. Sadia Aden, which contextualizes Somalia's relationships with countries such as Egypt, Ethiopia, Kenya, the US, the UK, and UAE. In the show, Dr. Aden unpacks the impacts of external dynamics, climate change, and more on the longstanding conflicts and political crisis in Somalia. Dr. Sadia Aden is a humanitarian activist and freelance writer. The full conversation is available on Africa Now's SoundCloud page. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. That's Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. The music in the background is musical Oud by Hadith Bani Adam. That's it for Africa Now for today. I'm your host, Muiz Omtali. Up next is Headline News, followed by Shanan Zain Alamin, looking at issues in Northern Africa and the Middle East, with a special spotlight on the plight of Palestinians. And after that is Women's Collective, Sophie's Parlor, which is followed by Human Rights and Justice with Nakichi Taifa. And that's followed by Black Agenda Radio with Margaret Kimberly, which is followed by Kombit Lakai with Eugenia Charles, looking at issues in Haiti. Check out Africa Now on Facebook and on Twitter. And that's at Africa Now Online. Africa Now is also archived on iTunes Podcast and on SoundCloud. Search under Africa Now Online on SoundCloud. Thanks to Africa Now's executive producer and co-host James Pope. And thanks to our engineers, Michael Nasella and Kalia Chapman. And thanks to our research fellow volunteers, Chanda Kozer and Funangonda, and the Africa World Now Project Collective of Dr. Tasmin Siddiqui, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, Dr. Josh Myers, and Kurt Utterson. And thanks to the entire team here at WPFW and to you for joining us. Continue to support all the great programs on WPFW. We're going to leave you the closing song entitled East End, West End by Eric Gale, remembering Eric Gale's birthday, which is September 20. Thank you. Have a great day. Have a great week.
and stay safe.
For WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Here are some headlines. Israel bombed the mountains north of Beirut, and Hezbollah targeted Tel Aviv for the first time today in a further expansion of the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah. Israel intercepted the missile fired near Tel Aviv, and there were no immediate reports of damage or casualties. Meanwhile, thousands of people have fled southern Lebanon to escape Israeli attacks, but today's attack fueled fears that Israel's assault on southern Lebanon could spread to other parts of the country. Israel's bombing campaign inside Lebanon has killed more than 560 people since Monday, and more than 1,800 people are reported injured, according to the Lebanese Health Ministry. According to a statement from the United Nations today, more than 90,000 people in Lebanon have been displaced in just 5 days due to Israeli airstrikes. In other news, Tropical Storm Helene is forecast to become a hurricane later in the day as it moves into the Gulf of Mexico, where the National Hurricane Center said it will intensify into a major Category 3 storm and possibly the strongest hurricane to hit the U.S. in over a year. Landfall is expected along Florida's Gulf Coast tomorrow, where people are being urged to prepare and several counties are under evacuation orders for what could be a life-threatening situation. Helene will be the fourth hurricane to make landfall in the U.S. this year and the fifth to slam Florida since 2022. The rapid intensification of Helene over the Gulf of Mexico raises again the potential of climate change to influence weather patterns. According to data from the nonprofit research group Climate Central, human-caused climate change made the current record-warm waters of the Gulf of Mexico between 200 to 500 times more likely. The House of Representatives is expected to vote today on a three-month stopgap funding bill to keep the federal government open through December 20th. If the measure goes into effect, the government would avert a government shutdown that is set to begin next week. In a move to gain support from Democrats, the spending plan, promoted by House Speaker Mike Johnson, does not include any part of the SAVE Act, a proposal demanded by Donald Trump that would require Americans nationwide to provide proof of citizenship to register to vote. Acknowledging that excluding the SAVE Act is not the plan Republicans would prefer, Speaker Johnson wrote in a letter to his Republican colleagues, quote, "As history has taught and current polling affirms, shutting the government down less than 40 days from a fateful election would be an act of political malpractice," close quote. Donald Trump has publicly insisted that congressional Republicans shut down the government unless the spending plan includes the SAVE Act. And the Justice Department filed a civil antitrust lawsuit against Visa yesterday, accusing the company of illegally monopolizing the debit card market. The lawsuit claims Visa engages in anti-competitive behavior and imposes unfair costs on consumers and merchants. Visa charges $7 billion in debit card fees annually, according to the DOJ, and its debit card business accounts for an estimated 60% of all debit transactions in the United States. Attorney General Merrick Garland said in a statement, quote, merchants and banks pass along those costs to consumers, either by raising prices or reducing quality or service. As a result, Visa's unlawful conduct